Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Telegraph's official Super Bowl 58 recap podcast. Wait, that's not right. Let's start again. It's the Telegraph Rugby podcast, and after two rounds, we have one obvious title favourite, and for the rest, just a whole lot of questions really, but fear not, because Charlie Morgan, Charles Richardson and myself, Ben Coles, we're all here to try and make as much sense of it as we can. Hi Charlie.
Morning Colesy.
Hi Charles.
Hello.
Where were you both this weekend?
In and around the Twickenham area, Ben. Took in England, Wales. And then stayed there for the rest of the weekend.
Great.
Ditto.
How was it? Briefly, before we dive in. How was your Twickenham experience? Because, you know, a lot of stuff last week about, you know, revamping the atmosphere and trying to improve it.
More annoying.
I think we'd been around it, hadn't we? We'd been around the build-up and we'd been listening to Jamie George for, and it felt like sort of 2-3 weeks, given that they're away in that first fixture and they'd made such a big thing about it re-engaging the crowd. To be honest, the only bit of it that I really picked up, apart from the new sort of playlist, was them trying to do a sort of half lap after their warm-up, and because nobody was there, because they were all watching the end of Scotland-France, there was a bit of a sort of rousing swell of volume, and then nobody really picked up on it. So it was a bit of a damp squib. And then it's always, the rugby comes first. As to be fair, Freddie Stewart said in media before, in the build-up, he said, look, it's our responsibility to rouse them with our performance. And when they missed two or three openings early on in the first 5 minutes, it felt like a classic, Wales are going to hang in here, make this a dogfight, suck all the energy out of it. And they did that brilliantly.
Mm. I mean, it was a strange one, because it was when it goes a bit flat, which, you know, it's live sport, it can go a bit flat. And people who are buying a ticket, you know, you take that risk, and I don't think anyone's expecting it to be sort of razzmatazz from minute 1 to 80. But when it went a bit flat, it was very sort of artificial. Right, get the band going, get that brass band going. You can almost imagine there's somebody there going, come on, it's gone a bit flat. Get that sousaphone up and running. So it all just felt a little bit forced.
I'm going to bet a lot of money there was not a brass band there.
No, there was.
Was there actually?
And they did. Aini Kamozi, Here Comes the Hot Stepper, in what? Brass band form.
What, in breaks in play?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay. I know.
Well, actually, that sounds a bit better than I thought. There's an extensive, not that that wasn't very informative from the two of you, but there's an extensive write-up on the website by Joshua Hughes who went and did the fan experience. This is where one of you asked where I was, because I can't ask
myself. Where were you, Colesy?
Oh, thanks. I was at Murrayfield, where nothing controversial happened at all. And
how panicky was the rewrite or on the whistle? That's what I want to know.
It was more a colossal reassessment of what we were going to do, and then suddenly sitting in the press box and rewinding the BBC's coverage and trying to pause and capture every bit of dialogue between television match official and referee, and actually also counting the number of replays that the TMO looked at. 10 is the answer before you
double figures.
Before you ask, 10. Although the last two were rock and rolled until they died because he looked at them for so long, four minutes.
It's like Kiss wants to rock and roll all night.
Oh, that's good.
And party every day.
That's good. Yeah. So Murrayfield was. I mean, the Murrayfield atmosphere is great. Apologies to Twickenham, but I really like Murrayfield as a place.
What was it sort of peak during the game?
What I should say,
because there are flat patches in that.
The reason the atmosphere was probably so good was because the French fans travelled very well, and actually the whole walk from Edinburgh Haymarket Station to Murrayfield, which is about 20 minutes, I barely saw a Scottish supporter. All I saw were groups of French supporters who'd clearly come over and were very excited. And when we'll get into the game, but after the Gael Fekir break and the Duhan van der Merwe somehow not getting penalised for stopping him short of the line, the boos afterwards, it felt like you were in Paris, actually. So well done to the French fans. Mm. Well done to...
We've spoken before, they love a boo, and they're really good
at it. Oh, they're so good at boo.
And a whistle.
Boo and a whistle. Honestly, they really brought a lot of entertainment to a game which was controversial, as we said, and we'll get into that. But let's start at Twickenham, where England edged past Wales in a tight game, which I think has left us with a few questions. Okay, guys, Charles, I'll start with you. England getting past Wales. Two teams who are clearly trying to figure themselves out, aren't they? And I don't know, how did you feel about England coming away from it?
Well, at least they got the W. At least they got the win, which was, I think, sort of bare minimum. First 10 minutes, I think we've seen this a lot. First 10 minutes, they showed signs. They were bright, I think, ball in hand. And then they just... The indiscipline costs them. The two yellow cards are always going to make things a little bit more sort of staccato and a little bit more difficult, both defensive, on both sides of the ball. Yeah. They're building. There were positives. The scrum went very well, and they've identified that as somewhere where they need to improve. Line-out was good, even with, at one point, two forwards in the bin, two line out jumpers in the bin, but yeah, they need a bit more oomph. I mean, how often do we say this? We say this literally every sort of post mortem of England, win or lose. We sort of say they need a bit more oomph. They haven't really got that in midfield at the minute, as in they haven't even got a player available for it in midfield at the minute. Hopefully, they will by the time they travel to Edinburgh. They do have some forwards who should also be coming back and who might do better than the ones who are currently there. I'm thinking the likes of George Martin. I'm thinking maybe start Ellis Genge and Dan Cole to have the Genge carrying threat from the off. And then you have to start Dan Cole with him, I think, because I don't think you can bring Marler and Cole off the bench together. When the game's breaking up, you don't want those two defending together. Again, as I said last week, no disrespect to the pair of them.
We had letters about that. family members writing in. And
Chandler Cunningham South has looked really lively off the bench, as has Theo Dan. I think I'd probably keep those two on the bench for now, but certainly there's a rejig up front that could happen just to give them a little bit more. Because they did some nice things, England, and they really did, but they were lacking in thrust.
Charlie, I'm torn how to approach England. I don't know whether to preach patience like we did at the start of the tournament and to just accept that things are going to take a while, or I don't know whether to be disappointed and because I'm not quite seeing enough progress. Where do you sort of sit on that fence?
I certainly don't think you could be blamed for feeling that you're not seeing enough, because I think that's why this next game against Scotland at Murrayfield is so interesting, isn't it? Because by that time they'd have been in camp for 5 weeks, so these excuses about cohesion aren't really valid anymore. I wouldn't say their defence, if you take both their defence and attack just in isolation, the defence was tested in a different way against Wales. They didn't A Wales midfield of Johan Lloyd, Nick Tompkins and George North were never going to move the ball as fluently as Italy did. But there's some tough, nuggety carriers in there, and Johan Lloyd's quite sparky. So it was sort of tested on the front door a bit more, and there was a little bit of weakness there by England. But what was most impressive to me is that they backed that system. They continued to double down on it. And the kind of key moment that I've written about from the game was... just after Wales's penalty try, England down to 13, they backed that rush to under Wales. It was really really interesting, because it was Wales have scored quite a few tidy long range tries at Twickenham in the last few years, and with England down to 13, they had this one chance to sort of really put a bit of daylight between them and England. They backed their attack, England backed their defensive system, England win the turnover when Itoje sacks Lloyd, and then Bennell goes off the base to score. That was a huge moment in the game. I thought we always another recurring theme of kind of looking back over England games is kind of justifying the stodginess by saying how they've been compromised in other areas, and they were. I thought the Chesham yellow card was super soft. Yeah, and I thought was. I thought the Roots yellow card was super soft as well. So, and Steve Borthwick was desperate to talk about that without sort of breaking his rule, which is not to kind of single out and slag off refs. But he was just saying, look, the penalty count in the first half remarkably was 6-0. Wales were squeaky clean despite sort of going quite hard at counter rucks and things like that. So for England to sort of work their way out of that is quite impressive in their 8 wins from 9, with a single loss being by a point to the world champions, which feels nuts. And that might have crept up on a few people, but they are certainly justifying the old, what Steve Borthwick keeps saying, which is that they're finding a way.
Those two yellow cards, the Chesham one, I mean, James Dolman, the referee, has said that he's always upright, which I just fundamentally disagree with. I don't think he is. And I think the contact to the head is minimal. I mean, I think it's telling that they stumbled for ages, didn't they, ever getting the pictures up. They, for some reason, they couldn't get the footage up, which again was another thing that just another little thing that added to sapping a bit of the life from the atmosphere. Because even in the press box, you were sitting there going, "Come on, this has got to be better."
I feel like that's happened in another game in this Six Nations already, where it's taken a long time to get.
Perhaps, and you couldn't blame the French TV directors for this one this time because it was in England.
Someone will have done it.
Yeah. And it was telling, I think, that when they were stumbling over getting the footage up, the TMO said, "Oh, we can't get the pictures, but it's just penalty only. Really, just it's a penalty here." And then eventually they got the pictures up, and then they were like, "Oh, it's a yellow card." Mm. It would have been insane had they upgraded that to red, I think.
And it was the quickest.
It was the quickest review turnaround, which sort of told its own story as well. And then on the Roots one, I think there is an argument that maybe he does collapse it. But there's absolutely no way on earth that Wales were scoring a try there because both Itoje and Roots himself had the ball. They were basically wrestling each other for the ball. Wainwright had lost the ball. So even if Roots hadn't collapsed them all there, there is no way Wales were scoring a try. It looked harsh at the time, and it didn't get any better on a rewatch, that one. This is not making excuses, of course, because you know there's a lot more that happened in the game, and you know there was that brilliant George Ford 50-22 as well, which we not touched on, which was an incredibly uplifting moment and really the match-winning moment. But yeah, I mean, England were hamstrung, weren't they? They were hamstrung by half time, and you know these things should be out of their control. Or should be in that these things that are out of their control should not be affecting the result or the final score of the match. But they did a bit, but even so, the better team won.
I think you, Charlie, said that the Chesham yellow card was a bit like Abraham Simpson, that sort of giver, it just comes in and out of the room straight away.
Yeah, well, we had Brendan Pickerel, the TMO, on the ref mic, obviously, and listening in. It was kind of jarring how he came in because so often you see those and you go, "Oh, that's going to get called back for that." So it's one where you didn't see at all. And the coaching point to Chesham is that Sam Underhill's already stopped Azzurati, and he comes in slightly unnecessarily. Is the one thing you potentially say to Chesham, but they're looking to dominate those collisions all the time, aren't they? Even in sort of inconspicuous areas of the pitch. But yeah, Brendan Pickerel was sort of quite guiltily going, "Yep, that's going to stay." Anyway. And he was just like, "Oh, well, should it be flagged anyway?" But you know, it is what it is. They found themselves in that situation and did pretty well to get out of it.
Just with the defence, and I say this with the Super Bowl fresh in my mind, I think people can probably forgive an aggressive defence which makes mistakes because you can see the intent, a bit like when teams blitz in American football. The attack, I think, is more of a grievance, and I'll open it up to either of you. Are you kind of scratching your heads a bit about why England just are not effective as an attacking team?
I wrote that it's kind of still read the piece on the website as a sort of on the whistle analysis, so be patient with it. But I think this has kind of got, it's been an issue that's lingered since just before halftime of the final in 2019, and it's important because scoring in fives and sevens just builds confidence, and if you mess up those opportunities, the pressure comes back on you, and that it just really felt that way in the first 5 minutes when they didn't have anything to show for some really good stuff on the counter. Freddie Stewart carving straight through, Freeman, Ford and Mitchell combining off another kick return, and then off the back of that, I think it's Stewart puts Daly right through, and all of that's really tidy, but they've got nothing to show from it, and they also botch a 5 metre line out. after half time. Daly gets forced into touch by Cameron Winnett. And even when they finally score, two tries, one from a piece of individual brilliance from Ben Earl off the base of a scrum, and then off a they almost contrived to blow a really kind of obvious overlap when the connection between Ford and Daly isn't particularly smooth.
I thought Daly was going to drop that.
Yeah, Daly's an interesting one. Why it's so difficult to fix is because it's potentially to do with the entire balance of the side, and you want carriers in the pack, but you don't want to compromise on your line out. You want carriers in midfield, but you don't want to compromise on your ability to get the ball wide. And that's why over the next couple of weeks, Steve Borthwick is in a bit of a tight space, because does he bring back Ollie Lawrence or Manu Tuilagi to give him that thrust at the expense of Dingwall when Dingwall's been pretty good as a link man? Does he bring back someone like, Alfie Barbary probably doesn't sound like he's going to be in the mix, but does he bring back more thrust in the pack at the expense of, you know, having this well-drilled, cohesive set-piece operation? It's really difficult.
I think if Manu or Ollie Lawrence are fit, then they're straight in at 12, aren't they?
Yeah, are you having to attack in a totally different way? You've certainly got one fewer ball player, and there's more onus on someone like Elliot Daly. It's just so difficult, and that's why it's so tough, I think, to without knowing on how much they're working on it and how they're prioritising training weeks, and they've clearly had to put in a lot of time on the defensive side because it's a totally new system. It's tough to know where they turn and how they get better quickly.
Will Greenwood made a very good point in his column for the Daily Telegraph at the game, which was essentially, the risk reward of this defensive strategy is fine, really, and leaking tries is fine, because it will take a while for this new system to bed in and to get fully up to speed and to get to the level that Felix Jones wants it to be, and that's fine. But then you're going to have to score more. It's about scoring more than the opposition. So if you're going to leak 28 points, not that they did against Wales, but they might in the games to come, then you've got to score 30 to win. And at the minute, it doesn't look like England could score 30 points to win a test match, and especially not against Ireland, probably not against France. Although I think that could be closer than many, which we'll come on to, that could be a closer game than many people are giving credit for. Could they score 30 points at Murrayfield?
I'm shaking my head. No, I don't know if I see it. And obviously, all points matter, which segues nicely into George Ford's conversion. And we've got a bit of audio from that from George, so let's hear what happened there.
To me, it doesn't make sense to me, that, mate. I'm trying to use the full shot clock time because we've got men in the bin. You're at the back of your stance and you have your routine, and if adjusting your feet maybe like that is initiating your run up, then I'm not too sure, to be honest with you. But we're going to have to stand like statues at the back of our run up now, you know, like, but it's right, because a lot of the thing with kickers is like you want to get a feel, and like you want to, and sometimes you don't quite feel right at the back of your run up, so you adjust it a little bit, and like, right there, I've got it now, you want your chest to be at the ball and all them things. So I think what it means for us as kickers, we've got to be ultra diligent with our setup and process, because if they're going to go down that route and look for stuff like that, then we can't afford that.
That's George Ford there on the conversion. Just quick opinions on that. The right call from the officials?
I think so. I think George Ford was fizzing even doing that interview in that huddle with us. And I think he gets asked, do you want to talk about that? And he was like, yeah, I do. And it really confused him. He was clearly angry at the time, but it was quite an obvious movement, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I think I understand why he feels aggrieved, because the law had always been approach the ball, that's when the charge starts, and he didn't approach the ball, he moved sideways. But now it does say in the World Rugby Laws, there's been a clarification in 2020 that it's in any direction. That's the first thing, which he should be aware of. If he's not, then I can understand why he feels aggrieved, but he should be aware of that. The second thing is, he claimed that it was to run the clock down and slow the game down a bit more because there was a man in the bin. Well, just wait before putting the ball on the tee. Run the clock. There's no obligation for you to put the ball on the tee. You can just stand there, run the clock down for 30 seconds with the ball in your hand, then put it on the tee, and then go through your normal kicking routine. You don't have to stand there like a melon doing your kicking routine.
I didn't really understand that part of his point. Him sort of going, I was running the clock down, and James Holman was probably going, cool. You yeah. you still move.
Yeah. That's yeah. Well, they can't charge me down. I'm running the clock down.
Yeah. You wait for a charge down conversion or a conversion error. Now we've had two in a few months, yeah. haven't we, with old Thomas Ramos? So, you know.
Well, I mean, this wasn't even charged down.
Well, no, I appreciate it. As I said, it does it even count as a charge down conversion? I guess it technically does.
It went backwards, technically.
The great thing, Rio Dyer didn't know what to yeah. do when yeah. he arrived. Yeah.
So how many got there and stopped?
How many times has he tried to charge down a conversion and all the time clearly not knowing what he's going to do when
that's
he
true. He's probably never got that far and actually yeah. been in a position.
But who was it who took the initiative? Was it Thomas Williams?
I think it was D. I think it was Elliot D. Booted it, yeah.
Good old D. Speaking of D and Wales, did you weirdly come away from this more impressed by Wales, given where they are with an extremely young side trying to find their way? I thought the kind of interplay leading up to the try for Alex Mann was particularly nice with Tommy Reffles, sharp line.
Great question. I am not sure. I felt that so much of their performance was geared towards stopping England, spoiling England, frustrating England, and they did that brilliantly. But sometimes, I don't know, sometimes you a side can be capable of that, and then almost that makes it less clear how they're going to move on and be proactive about their game. I think that try showed that they've got, you know, good footballers. They've got incision when they want it. It's how often they can do that for a lot smaller. There was a really nice ball from Johan Lloyd when Rio Dyer came round from the blindside wing, and Daly bites on to Dyer, and that leaves a space for Winnett, and it's George Ford's scramble that just stops what would have been a really, really nice try off second phase. They've got the ingredients now, and I feel like there's still a bit of a lack of clarity about how they move forward and connect all those bits of their game. And I think, as you know, Gatland has been totally open about how patient supporters are going to be. Word on Tommy Raffaello, he was fantastic, and actually, I think he's just a genius around the tackle area. People sort of peers just rave about how the minutiae of what he's looking at around there and how he thinks about it. But he's always been pretty he's always had a lot of poise and skill about the way he handles and migrates to those wide channels. It's good to see that at test level
too. I saw people saying this a lot. Can we start giving player of the match awards to players on losing teams?
I was just about to say that,
because it's getting really annoying. Like, you could absolutely,
he was easily player of the
certainly
match.
In Scotland, France, which we'll get onto as well, there were better candidates for player of the match than Gael Fiku, even though he scored the try, and Tommy Raffel sounded like the best player on the pitch
by a mile.
Just that point about Gatland and patience, I think it's quite interesting, because I'm trying to recall, I haven't been around England much in this Six Nations, but has Borthwick said similar things? Because I feel like when Gatland says be patient, we need a bit of time, everybody says okay, fair enough, and sort of believes him. And I just wonder whether that's because of Gatland's track record having won slams in the past, or do people just not believe England because they don't think it's good enough?
Well, I think this is where you're getting a real contrast in how they both approach it, Borthwick and Gatland. Borthwick hasn't, to my knowledge, explicitly said we need to be patient, but he's also kept a lot of very experienced players around to sort of ease this transition, whereas Gatland has gone, you know, broom out, new start with, you know, the few sort of more experienced players like George North, Josh Adams around, but largely in, you know, epitomised by, say, their captain and their fly half, it is a really raw side. So he can just link back to that and say, look, if we keep this group together, then we're going to see progress. Whereas England have sort of got that safety blanket, and therefore they've actually got less, I think, to point out when they're saying be patient with us.
And just going back to Wales quickly, and what you asked earlier about how impressed we were, I think. Yeah, I was more surprised by how fluent and organised they were ball in hand, and how intelligent they were ball in hand at times. But I think you've touched on it already. The Ben Earl try. Okay, that is very, very well taken, and a bit of individual brilliance from England. But that is arguably the ropiest bit of defence you'll see all weekend.
I'm glad you've said that, because I thought that watching the clip afterwards, having not been there. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I mean, that is a sort of missed, poor attempt at a tackle from Thomas Williams. Then Alex Mann is slow. I know it was only his second cap, but he was slow off. And then I think it was Johan Lloyd, maybe one other, have just got absolutely nowhere near him. And you know, Ben Earl is a very good player, but he's, you know, for really out and out an open side flanker. And really, you've had an open side flanker there demolish you like a world-class number eight. I know Ben Earl is an excellent player, and that's not to take anything away from Ben Earl, but no, I don't think anybody going into that game would have said that Ben Earl picking up from the base and carrying into heavy traffic is one of his super strengths, you know, and for him to sort of embarrass you really like that is not good.
Mm-hmm. Listen, an interesting game at Twickenham. Let's now chat about the other games of the weekend, heading up to Murrayfield.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Right, who's gonna interrogate me then about this game? Charles, Charlie, stick your hands up.
Watching on from the Twickenham press room, I couldn't believe how badly France attacked and what felt like bled into this week was their reluctance to kind of have that foundation of kicking at times and go through more phases. And when they did that, it just looked horrible.
So France's new attack coach is Charles.
Patrice Arletaz,
very good.
Who looks like Santa Claus and looks like he's about 90 years old. He's younger than Fabien Galthié.
Is he actually?
Yeah, he actually is.
That's not a detail I picked up on. Charlie, you're exactly right. There was a passage of play not long before the Fiku try where they literally just went ruck to ruck, side to side, no depth, no variation in running lines, no kind of signs of someone really trying to take the attack by the scruff of the neck, no one really getting over the gain line, where I just thought, I was watching it and I was thinking it can't all be not having Dupont and Ntamack there because we've seen that France can play well without, well, they can play well without one of them. Maybe playing without two of them is
hard. But also,
hard.
You know, a further argument to that is that Luka and Jalibert are the Bordeaux halfbacks and they've got that continuity and Bordeaux are tearing up trees. I've done him a dirty here. It's Patrick Arletaz.
That's fine. We allow corrections. I was similarly exasperated by how poor their attack was, but actually they were just dreadful all over the shop. Their kicking game was terrible. There was some comical catching of high balls from Thomas Ramos into touch. Matthew Jalibert, I think it was, who kind of dropped the ball quite obviously forward and then stood there looking as though someone had defended.
He was furious, wasn't he? He was banged to rights.
Yeah, it was absolutely ridiculous. They just had no control over the game. And the only time where they suddenly looked like France was where Francois Cross won a turnover on a Scottish forward. Might have been Sam Skinner or Scott Cummings. Anyway, and they had quick ball all of a sudden. Forwards were getting over the gain line and they managed to suck in enough defenders for Fiku to basically immediately walked over backwards into the amount of space that he had on the far side. That was the only moment where they sort of showed some attacking intent and direction off that turnover because they actually, for once, had forwards getting over the gain line and ball carriers who were effective. I thought they were absolutely atrocious for the first, I don't know, 50, 60 minutes. And really, that reflects back on Scotland because Scotland were, the Fiku try came totally against the flow of play. Yes, I know Fiku had that break where Duan van der Merwe somehow didn't get penalised either for a seatbelt tackle or for them being offside at the following ruck because he never retreated. I don't know how he got away with that, but we'll just leave that one for... It didn't matter in the end, put it that way. It was going to be the big controversy.
Yeah, and definitely not the biggest refereeing controversy that happened at Murrayfield.
And then it wasn't. But Scotland should have been so much further ahead. I thought Ben White and Finn Russell's kicking game was superb. They got great gain line carries out of George Turner and Matt Fagerson and Rory Darge. Rory Darge was great. But they weren't ahead enough. They're only 13-10 ahead at half time when they should have been 20-10 ahead. And there's two ways of looking at it, because they turned down three kickable penalties for the post in the final 5 minutes of the half. They could have kicked penalties, but they went to the corner once, had two scrums, and on the third scrum, Cyril Bye makes Zander Ferguson and collapse and France get away with it. Just brutal lessons, I think, for a team who were waiting, who can play. I genuinely, having seen them the last 2 weeks, they're quite a good team. Like, there's depth there. And they chucked in a 22-year-old debutant at fullback in Harry Patterson, who found out at 10 a.m. that he was going to be playing. He looked great.
Yeah, he looked great.
So I came away. Let's chat about the Timo thing next. But just a general point on Scotland. I think the frustration. Yeah, I get why people are annoyed about the decision. But actually, they should be annoyed with Scotland's performance as a whole, because they had this game won, and they should have won it, and they should have been 20-10 up at halftime, maybe even more, and they blew it.
It's also absolutely budget game management to turn down 3 points so frequently.
To do it three times in a row.
If when Ireland were doing it against Italy yesterday, rank favourites, Grand Slam favourites against, I think, you know, one of, if not the worst team in the Six Nations, you're sort of like, okay, I understand that. You're desperate for a bonus point. You're at home, blah, 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 blah. Scotland were not necessarily favourites for that game against France. In fact, I don't know what the odds were, but I'd be very surprised if they were favourites.
I can't remember it.
But even so, just take your points when it's on offer. I know France were down to 14, but they were only missing a tired prop, you know, Winnie Antonio, who is not the most mobile of defenders. So it's not exactly like they had a massive. I mean, they had a big hole to fill, France, but you know, it's not like they're missing one of their foremost defenders, France. And yeah, just take the three, lads.
But what I think we should say is the second half was atrocious, because France weren't getting anywhere, so they just thought, we'll kick everything long and we'll kick everything in field, and we won't let Scotland have any set pieces to attack from. We'll just try and keep the ball in play and hope for mistakes. And Scotland played into it. Scotland didn't disrupt that kicking game enough. They didn't try and, you know, attack more from within their own half. They just got sucked into it. Played into France's hands perfectly, took the air out of the game as well, because Scotland's momentum disappeared. And it basically set up the situation where Bielbiari came up with a wonderful chip and chase try, don't get me wrong. Mm. All of a sudden, Ramos has got a penalty and it's 2016.
How good was Le Garec again? I wasn't aware of how tough a defender he is. And we know sort of Dupont adds in so much. I think maybe we underestimated just how integral Dupont has been for that side. But Le Garec, super, super sparky. Not sure his pass to Bielbiari wasn't forward. But yeah, he's so good around the breakdown. He got a turnover straight after coming off the bench against Ireland, didn't he? And then he really added when Scotland were in possession, I thought.
France kicked fewer times than they normally would against Ireland. I think it was something like 19 times in the whole game. And then they kicked, I think, nearly 40 times against Scotland, so arguably more than they might have done. That is suggests to me that they were sort of trying to right those wrongs, and they've massively overcompensated.
Massively
overcompensated. And also, the second thing is, for a team that kicks a lot and who has five line-out jumpers, really, how bad was the line-out?
Terrible.
I mean, I don't understand what they're doing with Malvaca and Marchand at hooker now, because... obviously, Malvaca is outstanding and an absolutely outstanding hooker, but so is Julien Marchand. And they had always, always, like Toulouse, picked Marchand as to start, then Malvaca to come on with in the last 30 minutes, because Marchand is awesome at the breakdown, which is another area that they've been struggling at, and he has great arrows at the line out. For some reason, they've just gone, oh no, let's turn it all around and we'll start Malvaca now and we'll have Marchand on the bench. And the line out is really suffering. And that is the most inexcusable thing about France, to be honest, because Dupont and Antemac have nothing to do with the line-out, like nothing whatsoever. And they have five jumpers there. You know, both the second row's jump and the entire back row can get up. In fact, Olivon Cros are two of their, you know, greatest sources of line-out ball. And it just went completely to pot.
Yeah, hence why they just wanted to kick
And it was rubbish against Ireland as well.
And avoid the line-out. But it worked. Thing is, it's horrible to watch. And you have the ridiculous situation where players are then standing still because they don't want to be offside after kicks. And everyone starts booing because it looks absurd. But it did, if you from a French perspective, it did stop people like Van der Merwe and Tupilotu being effective in the game because they couldn't have the carries to get over the gain line. And Scotland all of a sudden were behind. I just, before we get onto it, because we danced around it, I just wanted to talk about how great I thought Kyle Rowe was off the wing. I think in two games now against Wales and against France, where he's looked really lively, fantastic for him after a really nasty leg injury a couple of years ago, which was pretty serious. He's come back and he's brilliant. Sorry, Charles, were you
going to... Almost won in the game at the end, didn't he? It was only a fantastic Jalibert try-saver, really.
Well, and in a way, it's his break. I know he knocks on at the end of the tackle, but that leads to the scrum from where Russell makes the turnover on Le Garrick. I mean, Le Garrick didn't get much wrong. And then we got to the end. Right, let's talk about it. I think you'll probably both agree with me that it is probably a try in that the ball has been grounded on the line. But because of the question asked by referee Nick Berry, because of the call made by Nick Berry in the field of no try, you're going to need rock solid evidence to confirm it. And after 4 minutes and multiple replays, there just wasn't enough evidence.
It was the wrong call, but for the right reasons, which is a strange thing to be saying. But rugby is a strange old game, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he gave it on field, no try, held up. Therefore, the evidence that the TMO has to be incontrovertible, completely conclusive, like undoubtable that there was a try scored. I don't think you get that. I know there's been stills going around Twitter of a circle around a ball on the floor. It looks like it's down. Yeah, it probably is, but probably is not good enough when it's on field, no try. The issue comes when Nick really, in the sort of whole culture of refereeing and the ball going over the line, they should be giving more tries, I think, on field in those sort of scenarios, because that looked like, if there's a finger underneath, that should be on field try, and then we'll go and have a look upstairs.
Luke Pearce has given that on the field, isn't he?
Definitely. Well, after the evidence yesterday in Ireland, Italy, Luke Pearce is definitely giving that on field.
So you'd have preferred a sort of along the lines of, is there any reason why I cannot award? Question.
Yes.
And then you would have needed concrete proof that it had been held up and
correct,
not been grounded,
which you didn't get.
Yeah,
isn't a real mess from this exchange between Nick Berry and Brian McNeice, where it seems like Brian McNeice is giving him the green light to give it.
Yeah,
and then Nick Berry and then Brian McNeice seems to sort of row back. It was that point again. Yeah, to take behind the curtain, we were just about to go up to our seats at Twickenham, and that was, I thought, oh, okay, Scotland won it.
Well,
because
and naturally everybody who's got a ref link in the stadium is seeing Brian McNeice say, I think the ball is on the ground, and is therefore thinking, oh, great, well, that's a try then. But the truth was he couldn't quite see it, and so he checked another few replays.
But then at one point, didn't the tables completely turn as well? And Nick Berry early on is going on the field, he's going, I think I can see the ball down here. And then Brian McNeice is going, I'm not sure it's like completely conclusive. I'm not sure I've got a conclusive angle for you.
So Berry never says that directly. He basically just echoes whatever McNeice says.
Right.
So when McNeice says, I think the ball's on the ground, Berry just repeats, so you're telling me that it starts on the leg and then the ball's on the ground. And that sparked confusion because I think people thought Berry was agreeing, but actually he was just repeating. And actually that was one of Gregor Townsend's points afterwards. He was sort of saying, the referee's stood in front of a massive screen. Can we not give a bit more power to the referee to actually just look at the footage and make a call as opposed to the TMO? Look, it's messy. Scotland fans, I get it. I get why you're aggrieved. It probably was a try, and yes, it would have won the game and you would have been 2 from 2. However, like I said earlier, the game should have been won earlier. You were the dominant team. You were the better team against the France team who look a bit of a mess and relied on some individual brilliance from their young winger to get over the line. Look, it's great drama, as Gaultier said afterwards in the press conference with a smile. He was like, what a great idea to have 4 minutes of video replays just to build up the suspense for the audience. And then when I said, well, would you like them to be a bit shorter, the process, he went, nah, in the end, I'm happy, with a big smile.
He wouldn't have been bantering around if it had been given.
I know. So dramatic at Murrayfield. Dublin slightly less dramatic, Charles, but very impressive what Ireland did to Italy, wasn't it?
Certainly second half, yeah. Certainly second half, they were very impressive. I mean, they're impressive first half. It's just that Italy were better in the first half. And it's just, they're so clinical and they're so ruthless, Ireland. I thought Italy in the first half, in terms of like the flashiness of some of their attack and the progress and sort of success of some of their attack, matched Ireland in the first half at times. Italy, but the difference was that Italy just couldn't sort of, all the plays and all the ball that Italy were using was all on halfway, and in the end it was just too easy for Ireland to sort of just lap it up. They could concede 10 yards and then they knew that Italy were not going to go 50 metres and score. Italy just refused to put boot to ball in that area, and they were playing some nice rugby and they did make some yards, but it was all around halfway. They couldn't get any territory. Ireland, conversely, would be winning penalties, kicking into the 22, and then you've got to try. There were, I think it was 322 entries in the first half, 3 tries, 2 conversions. That was game over. That was just game over. Italy, at that point, were 17, 19 points down, and that was just completely game over. And just in 3, bang, 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 3 entries into the 22, 3 tries. I mean, you compare it to Italy and the juxtaposition with Italy, but also the juxtaposition of England as well, of how England have played some really nice attacking rugby and after 15 minutes against Wales, deserved, in inverted commas, to be in the lead. And yet it was 0-0. And then you look at Ireland, and every single time they're in the 22, they're scoring.
Kind of an amazing stat from Russ Petty, who we will always plug on the pod for as long as we have a podcast, who said that it's the first time that Ireland have nailed a team since 1987, which I find particularly impressive in sort of the Andy Farrell kind of Joe Schmidt eras that we've just had, given how dominant they've been. I can't believe that no teams must just be sneaking 3 points and happy with their lot.
I'm going to have to apologise to Russ here as well, because I actually used that stat in the blog yesterday without crediting him, because...
Get out of the studio.
Because ITV just said it without crediting him, so I just put it in the blog, assuming it was an ITV original.
So you're going to do ITV dirty instead?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely stitch them up. No qualms.
Charlie, I'm going to put the pressure on you. Are we now staring at back-to-back Grand Slams?
Yeah, I think we were. We were upon Paul Willems's red card, weren't we, a bit?
None of us picked France to win the tournament,
nah,
did we?
No,
I mean, Ireland. No,
move on. Move on.
But it feels that way, doesn't it?
They look good. They look really, really convincing. Just then speaking about their defence, it's almost like, oh yeah, they're good at that as well. But because what you associate them with is just this relentless, intricate phase play where somebody like Jack Crowley can step in and just look brilliant. I was just kind of thinking back to how we'd rate all the sides after 2 rounds, and Ireland, not only have they got those 2 impressive performances, the second half against Italy drifted a bit, didn't it? But they've won convincingly twice, while blooding Joe McCarthy, Jack Crowley, even Calvin Nash come in and hasn't really missed a beat. It's seriously impressive stuff. They're 20-point favourites for Wales in a couple of weeks' time. Then they're at Twickenham. Scotland, if they get there, we spoke about this, didn't we, previously? But if Scotland get their act together, can they trouble them? Well, they haven't really made a dent on that rivalry for quite a while. So it's looking pretty inevitable, or as inevitable as it can be this far out.
You haven't mentioned another impressive debutant, who was 8-year-old Stevie Mulrooney singing the anthem before kickoff, who I think was we didn't do a moment at the weekend, but I think that's an obvious one,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Or Dan Sheehan diving for the 5 metre line when he thought it was the try line at the back of a driving ball. That was another corker.
What point of the game was that?
First half.
Oh, so still,
very much not a done deal.
Okay. No,
although it was a done deal, but yeah.
I thought the young lad on the doing the anthem was just fantastic. And more of that, please. I know we're coming off a French choir disaster at the World Cup, but individual singers, talented singers, they should do all of them.
Andy Farrell's comments afterwards, Colsey, you were tickled.
I've got them in front of me, just because it sounds like he actually played, where he was like, where Andy Farrell said, I thought, this kid's got it all. He was amazing. It sounds like he came on and had an amazing cameo in the second half.
But then doesn't he douse it by saying it was a good start? And he means good start to the day.
He nailed it, didn't he? It was a great start.
Feels like he's sort of dousing the hype ahead of like at the start of a big test career.
He's going to be moonlighting as the Irish Independent's music critic soon, Andy Farrell. He's off to the opera in Dublin last night. Hey, bit of Bizet.
Whatever works. He's clearly given them a little 5-point head start. So good on him. We'll get into preview stuff later, but I think Ireland will be fine. Like you've said, Charlie, should be fine against Wales. could England really just very quickly? Could you see it, Charles?
I could see it. I'm not necessarily convinced it's going to happen
by boring them today.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. In a sort of Springboks-esque.
Right.
Performance from the semi-final at the World Cup. That, yeah. I think that's the only way. I think, this is not completely pie in the sky thinking. England had Ireland troubled for a bit in Dublin last year until the Freddie Stewart red card. They were really aggressive and they ruffled their feathers a little bit. That could happen. Ireland will not be looking forward to going to Twickenham and taking on England, despite the fact that England's record of late there has been a little bit ropey. If England defensively show up like they did against South Africa and play like that, potentially with a few more strings to their bow, there's a chance. The stars would have to align, of course, and Ireland will go in as favourites, definitely. But especially if England are arriving at that game on the back of winning at Murrayfield, they will be confident. They will be confident, and in a sense, there'll be sort of one rung of the pressure off because they've won three games. Probably going to get at least third place, and then you've got sort of a free-ish hit against the Grand Slam favourites, and then going to France.
You're on the podium.
Yeah. Hey. England are currently 10-1 to do the Grand Slam.
I mean, let's move on. No more preview chat because we'll save all that for next week. But you very kindly sent in lots of excellent questions, so let's dig into them. Will asks, is Finn Russell going to have a field day against the Felix Jones blitz? Charlie, what do you think? He'll have a little chip kick.
Can't wait, is what I think. Yeah. But so what we hear about Felix Jones is not only that he's kind of been embedded with South Africa for ages and clearly structurally sort of overbearing structures from the Springboks. That's what he's bringing. But he's also really diligent as far as scoping out opponents' weaknesses, the sort of weaknesses and tendencies of individual players. That was something that came up, I think, as Francois Lowe told me that about him once. And as a case study of how to defend against Finn Russell, South Africa against Scotland in the group game in Marseille was fantastic. They were really clearly had thought about where they were going to apply pressure. They had a lot of shooters in that 13 channel to just cut off those passes. And as we know from South Africa, they're able to sort of adjust on the secondary. So if Finn Russell was going over the top with kick passes, which I think happened a couple of times, and maybe hadn't happened loads, but it happened a couple of times, and the sort of defenders were able to bounce out again. Henry Slade's going to be a huge, huge player in that battle, and it is going to be really interesting. Freddie Stewart's positioning as well, and his ability to sort of shoot around in that aggressive pendulum that we spoke about and get on the outside of his wing is going to be really interesting. I just can't wait. Just can't wait to see how it plays out.
And on a drizzly, dank day, what it could be at Murrayfield, that would surely play into England's hands even more, really.
Well, I said this in the piece about the defence, is if England get ahead, their defence and how their defence becomes becomes more valuable because they've got that scoreboard pressure, and therefore a team is potentially going to overplay and give them these opportunities. So they just have to connect up their game, England, and take chances, and then that makes their defence more powerful. But Finn Russell versus Felix Jones, what a cool little contest.
I just wanted to note on Finn Russell. Over the last 2 weeks, the chip kicks have actually, there haven't been that many, but the tactical kicking has been really, really good. And so I'd like to see how he can sort of shift England around and potentially get them opened up to counterattacks, which they probably don't want to defend if Scotland can get the people coming on at pace.
Yeah, it's a really, kicking against England at the minute, the approaches have been sort of mind-boggling for me. I think South Africa did it, and Wales almost did it as well at the weekend, which was just, Freddie Stewart's really good under the high ball. We'll see. We'll keep on bombarding him. We'll see how good he really is.
Feed the strength.
Yeah, I was going to say the spoiler alert, he is really good under the high ball. Wales kept on doing it in the first half and just getting no change whatsoever out of him. That is not the way to expose Freddie Stewart in the backfield. You know, he is not the quickest, not the most agile, not the most athletic of fullbacks when he's on the ground. He's very athletic in terms of his spring. Move him around, you know, and that's where Finn Russell's tactical kicking will come into it more. Move him around in the backfield, move this pendulum around, move England's back three around. Don't carry on giving him his favourite food all the time because he will lap that up.
Wanted to move on to a question from Chris, which is directed towards you. Charlie, about your article on attacking composure, and should England move on from some players who have historically shown a lack of composure themselves, or just stick with the squad? I guess what he means by that is it a personnel issue, or is it more systemic? I would say the latter, but I'll let you...
Yeah, I think the latter, because, you know, there are players that have been part of that, part of this whole kind of period where they've not been particularly... good there that aren't there, you know. So there's a new scrum half, there are new halfbacks, for instance. So yeah, I do think it's more about system and more about balance to selection, and the sort of, I think the personnel will be, you don't know for sure, you know, Chris might be right, and it's certainly a good point. But I would say that balance and just that, maybe a few additional ball carriers, I would say that would be more pertinent.
The funny offshoot from that is, I guess, that it's not, you can't clearly identify one player who is letting it all
gaffing
down.
It all the time.
It's just all not great.
Yeah,
it's kind of the wider point. Question from Adam: with Mike Catchy to leave Ireland this year, is there any possibility that England would look to bring him in? Haven't seen any progression, coherence in our attacking game so far, and we consistently fail to turn territory into points. In my opinion, Wigglesworth isn't the answer. I mean, you're certainly right about the failure to turn territory into points. Would Mike Catt come back into the fold? I'd be interested, but I feel like he wouldn't.
I doubt he would, first of all, and England might want him, but not in that attack pitch role. He was more sort of skills and like individual, the sort of specifics and the minutiae, as you said earlier, the minutiae of attacking plays, what he did in terms of the shape and the patterns. That's sort of been a Farrell thing, hasn't it?
Yeah. The more you speak to people around the camp, the more influence Andy Farrell seems to have on the wider framework of how Ireland attack, which is the sort of overbearingly impressive thing, right?
And that's what England need.
Yeah.
The skill side of things is need to improve, certainly. The skill side of things is not so bad, really. And obviously they've got Andrew Strawbridge, who's come in, who's working on a lot of those individual skills. I know it's more at the breakdown, but they have guys working on skills already. Kevin Sinfield is also working on skills alongside Strawbridge, and yeah, I don't think Cat would come back, really.
Sort of hinted at the beginning, it is the unknown for us on the outside is how much time they're devoting to it all, and it looks like Felix Jones has made an immediate impact in how they defend. It looks like that has been a big slice of their time together. That's what they've been working on. Clearly, to go to the next level, they're going to have to devote the same time and energy to that attack as well.
I mean, hopefully some time has gone into the attack.
You'd hope so. You'd hope so.
I know what you mean, though. Question from Andrew. Given the increased levels of abuse officials are receiving nowadays, do journalists have an increased responsibility not to stoke the fires when they're emotional, even if they don't like the decision? That's an interesting question, because I think we... do try our best to be as pragmatic and desensitized to it and just try and call it as we see it. I certainly think that we try and avoid just calling referees out kind of brazenly if we can, because it, like you say, it's not very helpful, and also occasionally we need to look at things three or four times to get it right, and referees often don't get that opportunity. I mean, I warmly encourage everybody to watch the Whistleblowers documentary, which I think is on Rugby Pass TV, but hopefully you'll get a wider release on YouTube, because it's a great insight into just into the abuse that referees do get, but also just the complexities of the role and how much time and devotion is going into it. Sorry, Charles.
No. It's a complex issue. Obviously, on the one hand, referees are not immune to criticism, and you know the criticism is vital for them sort of, you know, for their continual improvement and to, you know, keep pushing referee standards up and up, a bit like criticism and analysis that the players would receive. From a personal standpoint, I have felt an added responsibility after what's been happening in the World Cup to not certainly pour fuel on the fire. Not that I wouldn't say I was a particularly sort of guilty party beforehand anyway.
Not to pull back the curtain, but you referee as well.
Yes, yeah, so, no, absolutely,
so
yeah.
You're kind of in a more sympathetic position than most,
no,
I would say.
Absolutely. Although I don't get a chance to do it as often as I would like at the minute, because I'm doing more fun things like going to watch England at Twickenham.
Sorry,
mate.
You're slagging off, refs.
Yeah. So from a personal standpoint, I had this debate with somebody in the comment section of The Telegraph, actually, and I sort of said they were very annoyed in a Premiership match. I can't remember which one now. They were pretty sort of put out that the referee got the decision wrong on the field. Made quite an obvious error. Okay, but the TMO came in and corrected him, and he corrected his decision immediately. And the subscriber to the Telegraph in the comment section was very, very annoyed, and he saw it as a glaring example of rank incompetence of this referee. And I sort of went back to him and said, well, I mean, the officials have a tough job, we know that, and they do see themselves now more and more as refereeing as a quartet with the two assistant referees and with the TMO. And I'm sort of the opinion now, yes, it was a bad call from the referee, it was, but I'm sort of the opinion now that if we get the correct outcome with the four of them, that's okay.
Yeah. I mean that segues actually quite nicely into our last question from Mark, who says, should rugby get rid of the on-field decision rules and just ask the TMO to make the call? It feels like the process is hamstrung at the moment. So you're effectively, by doing that, taking most power for key moments out of the referee's hands and putting it into the TMOs. I mean, I've literally just heard Gregor Townsend 2 days ago say the opposite, that the referee should be having the final say, and the TMO, there's an argument that the TMO should just be for foul play and not for kind of try decisions. I mean, I don't know, what do you two think?
It goes one of two ways, doesn't it? It's either all power to the referee, but then we saw the danger of that in the Ireland-Italy game, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, if you take Scotland as an example, if the TMO has the final call there, that's still not a try. If the TMO has complete, absolute power there, that is still, that we've got the same outcome here, that France are winning that game. The only way that is given a try to Scotland is if the referee, who on the day was Nick Berry, who is the closest of all the officials to the ball, gives it. Or at least goes, I think a try has been scored. Mm. So in order for the Scotland try to have been given, if it was a try, it probably needs to be all power to the referee, because I don't think that a TMO analysing that footage is going to go, okay, the referee's got no idea, but I know conclusively that try has been scored. I don't think any TMO would do that.
Shout out to Yoram Mofana's leg for just being in the right place to completely obscure you.
Shout out also for to Laggy, because he waits until the ball's over the try line, so then he can just flop in. And with flop, he's like too big.
This is another interesting subplot. I was reading in Midi Olympique, the French newspaper, yesterday. Pasolo Tuilagi is adamant that he held that ball up. Even on that angle that has been going around, he said, my finger is underneath the ball.
Given the size.
Which is tenuous. But, you know, we will never know. This is the whole point, is it? We will never know, which is why it couldn't have been overturned.
It's quite a big finger.
It will be quite a chunky finger.
To be fair.
But him coming in from an offside position, he can only do because the ball's over the line, right?
Yes.
And that's pretty clever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, someone's written about this before, haven't they? How teams practice this. Trying to obscure camera angles and get legs in the way. I'm looking at both of you, and neither of you seem to think.
Sounds like a good piece.
Was it me? Maybe it was me. Oh, that seems like a good note to finish on. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. And thanks to all of you for listening to the podcast and for downloading. If you're new, welcome along. Please spread the word. The three of us are going to be back throughout the tournament, so make sure you subscribe so you do not miss an episode. There's loads of coverage on the website with our columnists Warren Gatland, Will Greenwood, Brian Moore, and loads of coverage from all of us throughout the tournament, so please keep on visiting. We'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.